Thank you, Sue, and welcome to everyone. I understand we have at least 50 people on the line, and there were a large number of folks in addition registered, so people may be joining us as we go along. And I want to just welcome everyone again from the Institute of Coaching. My name is Jeff Hull, and I actually recently joined the Institute as a new director of education, and I'm excited to say that we are kicking off 2014 with a whole new series of teleclasses and masterclasses. So hopefully it'll be an exciting year. I know it will be for me. And we're very happy to have everyone from the multiple time zones that are joining us on this call. Our goal today is to have an opportunity to learn from one of the wonderful keynote speakers that we had at our conference back in September. One of the things that we like to do here at the Institute of Coaching is keep alive this theme that we call the conference that never ends. So we like to continue to spread the word and the knowledge that comes from the keynotes and the research that's done that comes and is shared with us at our conference every September in Boston. So today we are thrilled to have Amy Edmondson with us, who is a professor at Harvard Business School. She's actually, if I want to get the title correct, so that I, there's always wonderful titles at Harvard Business School. So Amy is the Novartis Professor of Leadership and Management at Harvard Business School, and probably most importantly, has recently completed a multi-year research project on teamwork and has a new book out called Teaming that she's going to be sharing about today on the call. And if you are a member of the Institute, then you also are maybe aware that we have a master class that we just recently put up on the site, on the website, all related to the support of coaches involved with teamwork and teaming. And so I encourage you, if you haven't had a chance to look at that master class, there's going to be a lot of information there for you to continue to learn about Amy's work and also the latest research in team high performance leadership, and obviously how that relates to coaching. So the way we'd like to do this call over the next 90 minutes is I want to introduce Amy and give her an opportunity to speak to you about the work that she's been doing, kind of give some highlights maybe from her book and from her keynote, and then we will go into a bit of a dialogue because I've had an opportunity to research and look at her work, and as an executive coach myself, I'm also interested in how her work can be used in the practice of executive coaching or leadership coaching. So I prepared some questions for Amy, and she and I will move into kind of a dialogue format, and then we would love to hear from all of you. So approximately 45 to 60 minutes into the call, we will open up the lines and allow you to ask us questions or ask Amy questions directly. And if you're a little bit shy or not really ready to jump into a call with over 50 people, which we can understand, feel free to send questions at any time to my address. I'll be checking my email regularly. And the fastest email for me is actually hull.jw@gmail.com. Let me spell that. It's hull.jw@gmail.com. I also have an Institute of Coaching email, but it's not quite as quick. So if you want to shoot me an email, and I'll be happy to pass on the questions to Amy. So with that, Amy, are you there?
I am here.
So we are ready for you, and we're thrilled to have you, and I'm going to turn it over to you. As we've discussed before, I think the majority of folks are in the coaching world and looking forward to hearing about your book and your research, and it's all yours.
Okay, great. Well, it's great to be here, and we're in some ways embodying the new world of teaming and collaborating across likely disciplinary lines and certainly geographic lines. So, I want to start by saying it's not news that organizations today, whether healthcare delivery, new product development, software, manufacturing, you name it, depend upon cross-disciplinary collaboration or teamwork. And as I look around at the kind of fast-changing, knowledge-intensive global economy that we live in, it's clear that more and more people out there face a need to work together across disciplines, departments, sometimes even continents, often hierarchical level or status, to solve problems and get work done. And so that's in product design, patient care, strategy development, supply chain management, what have it. A lot of critical activities today depend upon cross-disciplinary teamwork. And yet, I'm going to, with that backdrop, I'm going to still stop and say that after 20 years of studying workplace teams, over the years, and especially recently, I have begun to believe that relying on teams to get the work done is a bad idea, which I hope, given what I just said, sounds a little bit heretical, and I mean it that way deliberately, because what I want to say is we don't really depend on teams. We depend on teamwork, or what I like to call teaming. Now, what's the difference? Teams are defined by the researchers who study them, and also I think the lay practitioner as well, as bounded, reasonably stable groups of people who are interdependent in accomplishing some shared goal. That goal could be, you know, winning the Super Bowl, like the Skyhawks as a team, or the goal could be developing a new product or caring for a patient, let's say. But the idea of being bounded, which means it's clear who's on and who's off the team, is absolutely central to a definition of teamwork. The idea of being interdependent and getting to know each other and practicing to do better and better over time is also very core to the idea of good teamwork. And yet, as I look around at the organizational world that I was just alluding to, there are fewer and fewer opportunities for stable, well-practiced, long-term teams, and yet just as much opportunity for teamwork. And so I've begun to get interested in what does it take to help people handle the fast-paced coordination, collaboration, relationship building, as it were, in far more dynamic settings. So what's needed is teaming, not teams. I see teaming as a kind of dynamic response to the demands of today's knowledge-intensive workplaces. It's not as if anyone would or should choose to work this way deliberately if you had other options. What I'm saying is that the nature of the work itself in many cases is just calling for it. It is indeed better to have, like a basketball team, the opportunity to build and establish a really skilled team that knows each other well and so forth. But more and more with 24/7 operations and fluid needs, we can't do that. So that's sort of one idea. That's why I increasingly use the term teaming and try to take a close look at what's needed to increase the chances of effective teaming. That is all a part and parcel of an even more fundamental interest of mine, and I think many of you, which is an interest in organizational learning. How can organizations be sensitive to, pick up on, and respond effectively to the changes in their environment that call for new and changing responses, routines, products, processes, and so forth. And I see teaming as an engine of organizational learning. Effective teaming, effective coordination and collaboration across boundaries is a really important way that organizations are able to be sensitive to and responsive to changes in the world. So what I'm really talking about here is learning and teaming at the same time, kind of hand in hand. I like to think of it, we have to get the work done, right? We have to, as many in business say, you have to execute. Well, my aspiration is to help people get the work done or execute, but as a learning process, as if one understood that with every step in any execution journey, one is also able to learn everything from how do I do that same step better next time to, wait a minute, what might be needed instead as the world is changing around me. So I call that execution as learning, and it's more than anything else, it's a mindset of just learning as you go and being very, very open to what your experiences are teaching you. And so that's those are sort of the big headlines: learning, teaming, execution as learning. Another major area of my research and practice has to do with creating what I call climates of psychological safety that allow these very uncertain and in a sense inherently risky actions that are involved in learning and teaming to take place without undue interpersonal fear or interpersonal risk. So let me pause here and see, Jeff, if you want to chime in or dig into any part, if that's enough of a starting point for us.
Yeah, I think that's actually great. It sort of, to my mind, frames up the conversation in terms of the fundamental concepts and context of the way we've always thought about teams, or I say always, I guess maybe, you know, within the last 20 or 30 years or so, we've all been thinking about teams as sort of structural, competitive, consistent groups of people that come together under, usually under what they have called historically a team leader, right? Mm-hmm. And I think what you're beginning to see in your research, and what I think we're all seeing, those of us that are coaching leaders and teams out in the real world, is that a lot of what we thought was the way teams worked is really kind of breaking apart right before our eyes. Mm-hmm. And what I love about your framing is that you're sort of rediscovering, reinventing, and redefining what it means to be a team. And it's a more fluid, interactive, kind of a live combination of mm-hmm. skills and people and talents. I think one of the things that would be interesting to hear you comment on would be your experience with because I want to get to the safety issue, but before we get there, I think it's really interesting for coaches, I know myself, to be asking folks that are in team leadership roles to step back and kind of reframe the way they see their authority in these situations. And, you know, what you're talking about starts to lead to a more shared leadership opportunity, or where people move in and out of leadership roles, or where there may not be like a strict person in charge. I know in reading some of your research, you were looking at teams that form kind of on, you use the expression forming on the fly. And I love reading about the hospital operating rooms where teams are forced to come together and they may not even be the same team one day to the next. So one of the things would be great.
Yeah, they rarely are, in fact.
They rarely are, exactly.
That's certainly a context where the surgeon is in a formal and even legal way the leader and must be. But I think that's okay. I mean, I guess issues of here's the deal. If authority, if formal authority, you use the word authority and sort of that the leader has to kind of come to grips with different meanings of authority. If formal authority, in fact, did what we wish it did, you know, which was sort of ensure that the job gets done well and, you know, in a timely way and with all good outcomes, then by all means, let's just have authority and let's get the work done. But the fact is, formal authority is a very weak tool for ensuring excellence in any realm other than the most clear-cut, you know, countable outcomes. So let me put it a different way. If people are making widgets, and I can go over and observe their output, and I can count how many widgets each person made and whether or not they're good widgets, then, you know, formal authority and formal rewards and formal punishments and all that will, in fact, allow you to get the job done and likely get it done pretty well. But as soon as I veer away from either one, and usually it's both, of those two assumptions, meaning it's countable, it's really knowable in a very, you know, objective sense how productive you were, and I'm also going to veer away from the individualistic nature of it so that it's done by you and you alone. So as soon as, let me put it in a positive way, as soon as the work is either interdependent and or somewhat subjective, or at least we won't know how good it was for, you know, you sewed up the patient. We won't really know, you know, for many months, if not years, how good an operation that was, for example. So either interdependent and slightly subjective or difficult to assess, then formal authority as a tool for ensuring optimal work, it breaks down completely. So now what's the role? You know, it doesn't mean you go away that we don't need leadership. In fact, I'm going to argue we need leadership more than ever. But the role of leadership is now one of, forgive me for this, but one of coach, of enabler, of creating the conditions, of giving feedback, of probing, of asking the questions, of encouraging the dialogue, so that we together can get our arms around our interdependence and get our arms around the subjectivity of what we're trying to do and be continually sort of pressing ourselves to do it better.
And Amy, let me ask you in that context, I know when I'm thinking about coaching folks that are in the teaming dynamic that you're just describing, which I think is more and more becoming the norm, even for regular old companies, you know, developing software with people working nights and weekends in India, Ireland, New York, Paris.
Right.
One of the things that I struggle with, and I bet folks on the call struggle with, is coaching team leaders or executives in charge of these kinds of mutable teams to know when to be authoritative and when to hand your authority off. Like, I think that this, you know, they look at the org chart and they see their name in the box on top of the team, but that doesn't necessarily mean, according to what you're talking about, that they're going to be more effective by being, you know, in the old way of leading. So how do you get folks to be comfortable with this more fluid
ownership of
the leader?
I mean, it's half logical argument and half emotional care. So the logical argument is similar to the one I just made, which is, you know, even if you wanted to, you would be unable to be as effective as I know you want to be in a sort of authoritarian manner. It won't work. By the way, what is the main thing an authoritarian manner accomplishes? It's to drive underground bad news. So it works.
Ah,
it's very effective.
Yeah.
In driving underground bad news, it means that, you know, unless you're right there, and by the way, you can't be everywhere at once, you're not going to necessarily hear about it. So, which means you might have the lovely illusion that all is well, but in fact it's not, and eventually all illusions do, you know, disappear, or get exposed. So, you know, part of the argument is just the logical argument that it doesn't work anymore, and I can say more about that. But the other part is providing the kind of care and support for people learning to lead or manage in a new way. This is hard for people, and it's meant to be. I mean, it's not meant to be hard, but there's no way to get around the fact that it's hard. We all went to school, and in school they told us, you know, here are the right answers, and the smart kids got the right answers and got, you know, praised and so on. And we all sort of grew up with this need to be right, the desire to kind of shine and all that. So it's making these transitions is not easy emotionally, and we have to support people in the new concept of failing well and learning fast, and by modeling the kind of supportive coaching and enabling the leaders, you're also showing and helping them see a new way for them to be with the people that they lead.
Perhaps you could share with us. I know, in reading a lot of your case studies, you may have come across some leaders that have made this transition successfully. And I'm curious what maybe some of their best practices are that you've seen.
Yeah. I certainly have. I think in a few years ago, you mentioned the operating room. So just that comes to mind first because I did a study of 16 cardiac surgery departments all adopting a minimally invasive technology at roughly the same time and observed them over a number of months to see how they, in a sense, changed their routines and engaged with each other in a way that was really dramatically different in order to make the new technique work. And over time, my colleagues and I found real differences in terms of how effectively the teams and the departments were able to make this change. And I wrote several articles about the study, but I wrote one in California Management Review called Framing for Learning. And basically makes the case that those surgeons, and they really were the leaders, they were decision makers in terms of deciding to adopt the new technology and then team leaders in terms of helping the teams and the departments make the adjustment. Those who framed the journey as a learning journey, and I'll elaborate on that, were far more likely to succeed in terms of making these changes and making them stick. And those who more or less framed the journey either didn't frame it at all, so then it's left to the default frame, which is a sort of execution journey, let's get this thing done, didn't create the space. And these guys really did, and they all were guys, 16 of them, they really did, the good ones, do it deliberately. They kind of understood what's it going to take to get people engaged and willing to jump in and change routines that they've been engaging in for a number of years. So what do they do? Well, it starts with purpose. It starts with, and I think as coaches, this is something one can help leaders clarify and articulate, but it starts with, I think, the effort that change takes and the challenge that anything new, new learning requires, needs some countervailing motivation that really speaks to both the head and the heart. And so to a organization, to a surgeon, those who succeeded were very deliberate in clarifying their shared purpose. We're going to do this as a way of helping patients recover faster. You know, patients will be able to go home a few days earlier. They'll be able to pick up a grandchild in a matter of a week or two rather than 2 months. And this is just really, going to be very revolutionary for them, for their experience, versus those in the hospitals where it didn't go so well. They were either didn't bother clarifying, the purpose seems self-evident, we're doing this to help patients, or in some cases they said, the hospital down the street is doing it, so, in order to stay competitive, we have to do it too. Well, that's maybe true, but it's not very motivating or inspiring. So the framing for learning started with a compelling purpose. It then, very importantly, extended to framing what their self and other. You know, my role, what's my role? My role will be to keep us safe, to be probing, to learn as much as I can from you, and your role will be, you know, to speak up, and what do you see, and what do we learn? I've never done this before, you've never done this before, we're going to be learning together, and so on. So, and your role is critical. And so they were, the learning journey, as I called it, the framing it as a learning journey, was really about framing the purpose and then the kind of distinctive and crucial nature of everybody on the team in doing something that would contribute to our success. And nobody, you know, sometimes when I talk about this, people say, oh, well, those were, you know, they were like that before. In this particular study, none of them were really like that before, very sort of teamy or coachy. They were, you know, they were cardiac surgeons. They were very top-down, very driven. But their sophistication and sizing up the situation led them to realize they had to really engage the team in a new way if they were gonna pull this off. So that was one case where I really saw some leaders changing.
Well, I would just interject that I think that the what I loved about this example is that the analogy to other organizations where, you know, we have a tendency to think that the aspirational aspects of surgery should be pretty obvious, but
but that's why,
know, right?
Right,
exactly.
You know, it's the very obviousness of it, which means we don't bother to name it.
Right. But I've actually seen in other organizational settings where, you know, a lot of teams in a more business situation they do get easily caught up in, you know, the reason for our needing to perform well is because of the competition or staying ahead of the technology or – so this idea of supporting as coaches, supporting our – you know, the leaders we're working with always staying connected to the aspiration that, as you said, connects head to heart, I think is a really crucial – transitional moment. I'm wondering if maybe you want to go on, because I think it's really important. I've already had a couple questions coming in on email to talk about this theme of psychological safety,
because
I know you do a lot of research in this area, and I think for coaches, you know, as we're asking our clients to sort of break apart their old, outdated ways of seeing their roles as either authorities or as driving results, and to start them thinking about ways to interact with the team that really optimizes the input, the skills, the knowledge, the capabilities of the movement of everyone in the group, that this topic of speaking up, feeling safe, being inclusive, that starts to become really crucial. And I think that's one area where coaches can be really, really helpful. So maybe you could speak a little bit about some of your experience with you know, again, either case studies or just some of the best practices that you've seen to help leaders create that inclusive, what you call psychological safety.
Oh, yeah. Well, you know, I should say that I set out to study learning. I didn't set out to study psychological safety. I sort of stumbled into psychological safety almost. Well, not almost, by accident, because of what I discovered. So more specifically, I was engaged in a study of with a team of physicians and nurses and others of adverse drug events. And the first thing that the clinical folks were doing was to sort that all the adverse drug events that we managed to collect data on in two hospitals into those that were deemed based on human error and those that were deemed, you know, not preventable, not predictable kinds of events. And so now let's think about the pool of adverse drug events that are attributable to human error. And then I discovered a very interesting thing across eight different clinical care units in these two hospitals. Statistically, significant relationship between the so-called error rates, or what I'm now going to call the detected error rates, and a variety of measures of team effectiveness, including sort of coaching-oriented, engaging team leaders or nurse managers in these units. And that, so in other words, what I'm saying is that rates seemed at first to be higher for the better teams, better teamwork, and I just couldn't quite believe that would be true. So I had to look a little more carefully, a little more deeply, and what I discovered was that, in fact, it wasn't that better teams were making more errors. They were more able to speak up about errors. And, in fact, therefore, and demonstrably, quicker to learn from, act on, counteract, figure out what to do next, and so on, the errors that did occur. So, you know, this became...
Can I interject here once?
Yeah, yeah.
I'm just curious because it starts to be a bit of a conundrum because I think you could see a situation where a team might actually report more errors or more mistakes or appear to actually be not as effective because they're being more transparent.
That's what I'm saying.
More honest.
Right. That's exactly what I'm saying. And I'm saying it wasn't obvious at first, and it took a fair amount of digging to show that that's what was going on. In fact, I published that in a paper called Learning from Mistakes is Easier Said Than Done, and I think that's true. Learning from mistakes is easier said than done, particularly in organizations that are sending a strong message that mistakes are not allowed. Now, that, you know, it's not that anybody wants mistakes or should celebrate mistakes, but we sure as hell want to talk about them, identify them, and learn from them and correct them as quickly as possible. So,
but it also means that we have to change our definition of performance in some cases, almost.
Exactly, and if we're in a well understood, highly mature knowledge area, well established process knowledge, say in assembly, you know, machine based assembly line, then we can expect, and in fact, most organizations today are pretty good at producing, you know, 99.999% perfection, perfect products. But if we're doing, you know, stem cell research on the front lines of the biological frontier, then it would be absolutely crazy to expect 99%, you know, positive results. Then we're going to expect, you know, 75% failed results, because that's the nature of life on the frontier. And so the part of really effective teams and teamwork, and why I think psychological safety is so critical, is the ability to have a mature, thoughtful, coherent conversation about the things that can go wrong and the things that did go wrong. And so your word transparency is absolutely, absolutely right, absolutely essential. The good teams, whether they're on the assembly line or in the biological laboratory, are those who are able to have mature, thoughtful, transparent conversations about that which goes wrong, not just that which goes right. And that's hard. And that's why, you know, that's why I like to argue, you know, the need for coaching will never go away, because human beings will always find talking about failure and error a little bit troubling or unpleasant, and we all need to be enabled and coached and supported in our efforts to do so, because those phenomena are not going away.
No, and I think that what you're heading toward is the next topic, which is sort of an obvious follow-on, that I love in your work, which is that once you have, maybe with some good coaching, mm-hmm. developed a sense of what it takes to be an effective leader, that includes creating that sense of safety and mm-hmm. that sense of transparency, and then you can move even more advanced toward what you call creating learning zones, mm-hmm. where you're both innovative, but you don't lose a sense of accountability. And I love this paradox because I think those of us that coach team leaders or senior executives that are responsible for delivering results, right?
Yep.
You know, it becomes a really almost paradoxical situation
mm-hmm.
where the goal of a learning zone is to be able to learn quickly from mistakes, but almost to celebrate mistakes.
Right.
And so maybe you can talk a little bit about what you've experienced with
yeah.
this idea of creating
you
a
know,
learning zone.
I just realized I will do that, and I just realized I didn't fully answer your prior question, which is, you know, I told you how I sort of stumbled into this phenomenon. And by the way,
right.
a key piece of this phenomenon of psychological safety is that even within the same organization, whether that organization is, you know, a major famous tertiary care medical center or a car company or a software company, even within the same strong organization, there are substantial differences, statistically significant differences in psychological safety from unit to unit to unit, you know, work group to work group to work group. And by the way, a lot of that comes from the proximal manager, you know, the team leader or the boss who is sending either very subtle or not so subtle signals about the acceptability of mistakes and failure and so on. So, I mean, if you just stop to think about it, in some ways the default is a lack of psychological safety. You don't show up at work and kind of assume, oh, I could just, like, be myself and anything goes here. And by the way, I'm not advocating anything goes. But, you know, none of us wake up in the morning, as I like to say, thinking how great it's going to be to go to work today and be seen as ignorant, incompetent, intrusive, or negative, right? I mean, that's just not.
Yes, I'm looking forward to screwing up this afternoon at work.
Right. Or no, I don't even care about it. It's not even screwing up. It's being seen as a screw-up.
Right.
We're very deeply allergic to being seen as a screw-up. And even less extreme, I don't even want you to think I'm stupid. I don't want you to think, you know, it can be the littlest thing, the latest, you know, YouTube that got a million hits. If I haven't seen it and you're mentioning it, I might feel like, oh, I can't admit that, you know, I haven't seen it or whatever it is. So, none of us start out wanting others to, you know, if you don't want to look ignorant, you don't ask questions. So we're all pretty good at, you know, at sort of stifling the very real questions we have. If you don't want to, you know, be seen as incompetent, don't admit mistakes, and so on. And so what I'm saying
is that's one of the reasons why I use that word paradox, because I think a lot of the time as coaches, we're encouraging our more innovative leaders to really step back and reframe what it means to be effective, because they need to encourage people to make mistakes, encourage people to speak up, encourage people to give them feedback, which is almost antithetical to a lot of what it took to become a leader in the first place.
Right, and what I'm going to do, I think I'm going to help that with that, because I want to say it's not, because I don't think you'll get anywhere telling, you know, either chief of surgery or the head of product development that we want people to make mistakes. We don't. You know, we want people to not make mistakes. But so I'm going to have to clarify that. Like, where are the places where it's helpful to – I mean, where are the places where mistakes are not sought after? They're never sought after, but they are inevitable, so we need to talk about them. I'm right back to that. But so psychological safety, I'm going to say that the default is in the workplace is no psychological safety. But effective leaders, effective managers – find ways to create with a sense of humor, with exhibiting trust, with really demonstrating respect, to create an environment where in fact, I don't think of it as I'm going to be seen as stupid if I ask that question. I think of it as I'm going to be seen as helpful if I ask that question. If I don't know the answer, probably someone else here doesn't know it as well, and I'll be the one, why not? You know, I'll be the one to ask it. Or I'm not going to be seen as negative if I criticize a process. I'm going to be seen as perceptive if I criticize a process. So what can leaders do to kind of flip that very basic human response, you know, and flip it around and realize that you got to create what, you know, a learning climate or a psychologically safe climate. And I just, you know, there's just sort of a few simple things I think you can do. You can be more accessible, more approachable, you know, do things to, what that means is going to a large extent depend on what the workplace is, but whether it's an open door, whether it's going out and asking people how they're doing and so on. Acknowledge the limits. As a leader, if I sort of say, gosh, I might miss something, I need to hear from you. I'm acknowledging my limits. I can also acknowledge the limits of our knowledge. You know, nobody has ever made a chip this fast before. We're going to be first. It's not really known how we're going to do it, right? So just those kinds of things, if you're continually calling attention to the your own limits, the limits of current knowledge, highlight failures as learning opportunities, model respect, demonstrate trust in people's abilities and so on, that's what you need to do to give rise to a psychologically safe workplace where we can have a kind of adult, mature recognition of and response to the mistakes, failures, and so on that do happen. But now back to, you know, a mistake is not a mistake is not a mistake. I like to divide the world into three buckets, a little simplistic, but one bucket is like I was talking about before, the machine-paced assembly line, where we have really good knowledge about how to make this car. Now, let's make it, right? Let's make it perfectly every time. The other end of the spectrum is, as I said, the sort of, you know, basic science, where we're literally on the frontier of knowledge. And in between, we have domains that I'd like to characterize as complex, where we know a lot, say a tertiary care, patient care hospital. We know a lot about medicine, about diagnosis, treatment, and so on, and we've never stood in this exact river twice, so that at any given moment, things may and, in fact, likely will happen that we haven't anticipated. So we have to be very alert. And so mistakes can happen because of novelty. Mistakes and failures can happen because of novelty, or they can happen even in routine settings because someone's not yet expert or not yet well-trained. And all of those things have very different meanings. In every case, we want to hear about them so that we can learn fast and make the changes we need to make. But the meaning is very different. So I don't think managers or coaches will get anywhere going out and saying, oh, yeah, mistakes are great. Let's have more mistakes. No. But they'll get quite far, and I think need to get quite far in saying we need to acknowledge and anticipate the places where mistakes or failures may happen and have a good strategy for coping with them and learning fast about them.
That's, you know, as I'm listening to you, what keeps coming up in my mind is this idea of what I would call necessary vulnerability.
Mm-hmm.
And, I mean, I'm kind of making up that phrase, but speak to that a little bit. I mean, I'm thinking about surgeons because I also do some mm-hmm. coaching in hospital settings with academic leaders,
yeah.
physician leaders, but also in corporate settings. And I just, you know, as you're talking about I'm thinking of the dynamics that are necessary as a poor leader to create this kind of safe learning context.
Right.
And certainly speaking to it, you know, speaking to it aspirationally, speaking to it in terms of setting the tone. But then the modeling, you use the word modeling, and I'm curious to hear you share a little bit about what you've seen as like the limits of vulnerability, because I think there's a place at which leaders are now, and as coaches, we're pushing a bit, I think. You know, the coaches that are on this call are probably all working with leaders that they're kind of, you know, we're pushing and supporting and cajoling to help our leaders move in the direction of being this kind of role model. And it does call for a level of vulnerability that I think a lot mm-hmm. of people in leadership roles are
yeah.
really either uncomfortable with or new.
Right.
So, you know, maybe if you could speak a little bit to your experience with that, it might be helpful for everyone.
Well, I like your phrase, necessary vulnerability, and I think it's in many ways it goes a fair distance in helping answer your question, which is to say that if it weren't the case that demonstrating some vulnerability would help you get where you want, i.e., a safe, excellent procedure, we wouldn't want to advocate that you do it, right? There's no, there's no joy in torturing people and making them feel uncomfortable because they were asking them to be more vulnerable than any of us want to be. But we're going to ask it anyway because the argument is it's the only way to deliver safe, effective work in we're talking in the operating room here, but the same is true if you're leading a major new product development project or a rescue mission or anything else. If I can't show vulnerability, it would be completely crazy to expect anyone else to. Now, what is vulnerability? Vulnerability is a factual condition. We're all vulnerable, right? We're all vulnerable to
right.
bad things happening, being hurt, to feeling inadequate. That's just a fact. And then the question is, are you willing to share that fact with others so as to help them do better? And at a very deep level, people, I think, have to make that choice and make that commitment.
Well, I think it's very
more comfortable.
Yeah, and it's such an interesting sweet spot for coaching and for leadership, evolution, I think, in the context that we're talking, because I know that often when I introduce the idea of vulnerability to a senior leader, in a bank or
yeah.
a software company or, their
yeah.
first reaction is, oh, so you want me to become all touchy-feely.
Right.
Okay,
right.
So I'm going to go get my new age self-help books out and,
right.
We're all going to sing
right.
Kumbaya. And, of course,
right.
that's not at all what we're trying to get at.
Right. And, of course, there is a paradox here, right?
Right.
Sorry, I didn't mean to interrupt.
No.
Paradox.
I'm loving what you're talking about, and I think we're all, as coaches, struggling with, how to support leaders to develop this type of modeling in a way that
right.
keeps them at the edge of effectiveness,
right.
but lets them drop this idea that they have to be invulnerable, that they have to be
right.
the authority, that they have to be right. And I really think that this is a truly leading edge place for us as coaches and as leaders. So I think it's just an important piece of the dynamic that we're trying to create.
I think you're right. And I think that the paradox is, or perhaps it's better to say it, the misconception is most people think that they look, stronger, better, what have you, when they are not displaying vulnerability, i.e. not asking a question, not admitting that they don't know, when in fact, from the observer perspective, it's not the case. The person who looks strong and at home in his or her skin is the person who is cheerfully saying, oh, I didn't realize that. Oh, that's interesting. Tell me more. And admitting lack of knowledge, asking questions, acknowledging the challenge ahead or what have you. The people who are, in a sense, brave enough to be open about challenges, which really is another word for saying be vulnerable, are, paradoxically, they do look pretty compelling to most of us. Right? It's like, wow, there's something quite they're the ones that if you're at home in your skin, you're better able to, admit the gaps in your knowledge because you feel good about the rest of it, which is not gaps.
Yeah, and I think what you're pointing to now is also something that you've studied extensively, and maybe you could comment on that specifically, which is creating that environment where people feel willing to speak up.
Yeah, so
right?
I mean, I was starting to talk about that before, which is, you know, what do you need to do? I think one of the most important insights is that the leader, the boss, the what have you, has to be willing to go first. Like, if I want people in my group to speak up about mistakes, to ask questions, what have you, and I'm the boss, I have to go first. It's like completely crazy, really, and yet it doesn't stop managers everywhere from doing it, to assume or to ask others to take the risks, the interpersonal risks, if you're not taking them yourself.
Although you've probably seen that in some of the organizations where you've worked, where there are like teams within teams, where there's a sense of psychological safety within one setting, and then in the very same organization, one level up or one level over, there's a lack.
Absolutely. And yet it's nearly always attributable to the psychological safety that's present is nearly always attributable to a proximal, a local, nearby status figure of some kind. Oh, usually, the boss, the team leader, what have you, but the closest one. So my psychological safety at work is more affected by my department leader than by my, CEO. Right? The CEO may be terrific or not terrific, but he or she is quite far away from my experience. But, person who runs this bank branch or this team or this project who has more power and status than I have is the person who really sets the tone for me and my colleagues right here. It doesn't explain all the variance, but it is a very important part of the variance.
Yeah, and what's interesting about the way you're describing it is you're also talking about almost like umbrellas of protection.
Mm-hmm.
That there are some subset organizational teams, within larger frameworks where the leader manages or the shared leadership manages to create that sense of safety for themselves.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
And I imagine that they create a bit of a bubble because at some point there's probably a place where it may not feel safe to go all the way to the CEO or to the division chief or bless you.
Thank you.
So
I mean, in the best of all possible scenarios, the bubble, you sort of live in the bubble for a while and then you take it with you. Like, I've learned a habit of speaking up, of asking questions. I'm going to sneeze again. Phew, sorry.
Bless you.
I think that was the last one. I'm allergic to telecalls or something. All right. So I think the problem is there's a big asymmetry where I learn that actually it's okay to be myself here, to offer my ideas, to critique, to point to failures, and then I get somewhere else and all it takes is one bad response and I may go silent now for quite a while.
Yeah, and what you're making me think about is I can think of at least two examples of my coaching where I've had a lot of success, in fact, even using some of your work to get a team leader or a division leader to open up and kind of break their boundaries of how they see their role and actually explore what we're talking about in terms of creating creator safety, innovation,
right,
transparency, and yet they bump up against a leader above them that's not having any of it. And so one of the things they look to me for as a coach, and I bet there are a lot of people on the call that may have found themselves in this situation, is how do I manage upward? What can you help to get your boss potentially get on board. Have you had any success in seeing some of the best practices around that? It's that whole managing up thing.
Sure, but let me back up first, because one of the funny things about that is that nearly everybody that I speak to has that, you know, that question comes at a certain point. And it's the funny thing about that to me is that question's in people's heads well before, or it's much louder in their heads than the question of what should I do to help the people who look to me. And that's natural. Human beings, we are oriented to look up, right? It comes from evolution, what have you. We're hardwired to kind of pay attention to what the high status folks think, because once upon a time, that really determined our very survival. So the very first conversation I want to have with people when they raise this issue is, first and foremost, you are that person, and usually the people I'm talking to are that person to way more people than, you know, the person who's supposedly limiting their ability to go forward. Right. In other words, they're at a certain level in the organization, and there may be hundreds or thousands of people below them and only dozens or hundreds of people above them. And yet the first thought is, well, wait a minute, you know, they won't let us. They don't act this way. So at first, the major influence you have as a leader is your ability to influence those below you. Right. So first, start there. To help,
right.
You know, ignore the people above you for the moment. Do what you think needs doing for excellence. Explain it, model it, engage them. Go to town. Like, let the performance, you know, ultimately speak for itself. Now, that's it. So first, I think the first thing they need to do is realize how much more important it is for them to think about their impact on those they lead than to worry about the fact that they believe they can't change the behavior of those above them. And then the second bit is, you can start to engage the conversation. You can start to explain, in a sense, the very real goals and aspirations your unit and you are attempting to achieve, how you see that, what you're up against, what's going to work in terms of getting the data and experimenting forward, executing as learning, and so on, to get there, and invite their help and feedback. You may not think you have influence, but a well-conducted set of thoughtful questions and explanations about what you're doing and seeing can have a very profound impact on someone who hasn't thought about it that way yet. But the main thing is you're rarely in any position in any organization overly limited, unless you're being micromanaged, which is another problem that you can also address. Your hands are not tied in terms of how you lead, how you get done what you need to get done. So it becomes almost academic. Okay, I can't change them. Well, A, let's challenge that assumption, but B, who cares?
Right.
Do your thing, right? Worry about your
problem. I absolutely love what you're saying, because I also think that one of the ways that leaders sort of in the middle of an organization or that are struck by the difficulties above them is one of the ways they can, resolve or move forward with this dilemma is to use the very modeling that they're using with their own team with the folks above them. And often it becomes sort of a non-issue when the boss sees how things are changing. So
that's right.
I really appreciate what you're saying about focusing on what you do have control over.
And ask for what you need. You know, it's Sam Colbert, do you know him?
I know the name.
UCLA wrote a book called Get Rid of the Performance Review, and then you wonder, well, what?
Right.
Well, it's great. It's a great, great book. But it's he advocates, and then explains in wonderful detail, I think, at the end of the book, he advocates the performance, forget the performance review, and he explains all the reasons why they're usually badly done and badly used and so on and not effective. Let's have the performance preview. And in that, both boss and subordinate have a crucial role to play in having a learning-oriented, planning-oriented conversation about what needs to get done. And so if I'm talking to my boss, I have a responsibility to ask the questions I need to ask, for the support and help I need to ask for. And so I can both model the behaviors we've been talking about, and I can also be letting my boss know what I need to be effective, which may include some of the things that we're talking about here.
And that also points in the direction of creating a dynamic that's more learning-oriented as opposed to assessment-oriented, which is really great. I want to stop us here for a second, Amy, and let you take a breath, maybe get a glass of water if you'd like, because
I don't know
nonstop.
Where the sneezing jag came from, but, yeah, I will. I'll go get some water.
And while you're doing that, I'm going to take a sort of process moment with the group because we've hit the one-hour point, and I have received a couple of great questions, but I also want to give people an opportunity to chime in. We do have over 100 people on the call, so what we're going to do is instead of unmuting all the lines, which can create a lot of noise, I'm going to ask that anyone that does have a question to unmute your own individual line by pressing #6, and then feel free to just say hello and jump in. I'm going to start right out with a question that I've received online, and that is, she didn't say her name, but she's wondering, how does a leader find the balance, and I'm assuming how does a coach help with this, find the balance between caring for what your people need and your team needs and sticking to your own vision as a leader?
It's a great question. I mean, I tend to think that your vision as a leader can and must accommodate what your people need. So let me think about this a different way, which is if in a sort of oversimplified way, as a leader, I can't do very much, right? I can only engage and inspire people on my team or in my organization to get out there and do what it takes to, you know, find and serve customers day in and day out with the products and services that we design and produce. And so my needs as a leader in the most abstract sense are very much aligned with finding ways to accomplish those complex goals together. When I perceive a conflict or a trade-off between my needs as a leader and the needs of my people, I think the thing you have to do is make it discussable, is raise it, rather than wrestle with it privately in my own head and sort of see it as a dilemma. I have to articulate it and get your help, right? They're smarter than you think. There will be ways in which they are not aware they've put you in a bind or that you're feeling a conflict, and then there are ways where you're misunderstanding what their needs are. So we make it discussable. We work on it together. It's not a kind of, I'm the boss, I'm supposed to have the answers, I'm supposed to be everything and everyone for them. It's, I may have a little more perspective, a little more longer-term vision, but we're in this together.
Yeah, I love what you're saying, because I also think that this piece around aspiration is, as you spoke earlier, you know, connecting head to heart. Mm-hmm. And I think that historically, you know, the traditional business view of vision and mission has been pretty much all head.
Yeah.
And that once when we look to include the heart and have an emotional connection with the vision, it really can no longer just be one person's vision. It really has to be a we. And so when you're talking about creating it together, I think that that is pointing in the direction of, you know, having a more dialogical approach to crafting the we, which will hopefully meet the needs of both the leader and the team. And that's what you're pointing to.
Right. And I do tend to think it's there's a sort of when you're in a bind, you know, name it. Very first, it's not, it's very counterintuitive or counternormative, but name it, you know. Not quite sure how to wrestle between these two competing goods. What do? You should ask for help.
Yeah, that's great. Let's take a second and see if anyone, if anyone out there wants to jump in with a question, we will take a breath and let you do so. I think we have a lot of shy coaches, so I'm going to go ahead and
take it. Well, 100 people, isn't it?
That's it's
a
intimidating,
lot of
right?
Laura Hauser, can you hear me?
Yes, go ahead, Laura.
Yeah, great. Yeah, I think I sent in an email, and, you know, Amy, I'm just really, really appreciating all that you're bringing forth to us today, both in terms of your research and your thinking and your enthusiasm. As you were going through talking about some of your different research and giving, you know, great examples, and in particular talking about, let's say, you know, psychological safety. Part of my background is in organization development. So, master's level, PhD level as well. And many of the elements that you were talking about in terms of psychological safety and, you know, how people get, you know, in terms of engagement, et cetera, many of the things that I'm hearing you talk about strike me from an OD practitioner and educator are also, you know, solid OD principles and practices. So I'm just kind of wondering, you know, kind of your frame and foundation where you're coming from and how you might see some of what you're talking about being similar or different to, you know, foundational principles and practices in organization development, which, of course, we also look at coaching. Coaching also comes from the context of consulting. It was one of the roles, one of the many roles of the consultant.
Yeah, no, and I don't really make a big distinction. I think that in our fields, we continuously stumble up against and rediscover very universal truths about human nature, about group phenomena, and about social or organizational, you know, social meaning societal or organizational phenomena. And so we together discover things that don't work automatically. Like there's a whole bunch of things that, unlike gravity and, you know, weather, don't work automatically. They tend to produce malfunctions of all kinds. And so, you know, leadership, management, coaching, organizational development, consulting are all needed to help not just get us back on track, but continually reinvent what the track ought to be moving forward. So I think it's all very consistent. If that means, you know, there's nothing new under the sun, I think there's a bit of truth to that.
Well, you're reminding me of many years ago. I mustered up the courage to send an article I was getting ready to publish. I sent it to Bob Tannenbaum, you know, father of and I remember Bob came back to me and he says, you know, well, Laura, I really, you know, I got to tell you, it's really well written, it's really well done. But I got to tell you that this isn't really much different than, you know, what my colleagues and I were doing back in the 50s at, you know, UCLA, in the 50s and the 60s. And, you know, so I kind of fell to the ground.
Yeah, but actually, I think that's a pretty big compliment.
Yeah, it truly was, and so he talked about, you know, some fundamental, you know, principles, and like you're talking about, you know, human nature, and, you know, et cetera.
Mm-hmm.
And I said, well, you know, if you put it that way, Bob, I said, you know, it strikes me that we can go, you know, back thousands of years. I mean, we can look at the, you know, what's written in the Bible and before that, and,
yeah.
You know, many of the things we're talking here really are, you know, very fundamental, you know, principles. And he kind of stopped and paused. And said, you know, Laura, I think you're right. You really need to publish this because you have a unique way of expressing, you know,
right.
That which, yes.
Yeah, I want to jump in here, Ben. I want to jump in here, Laura, and I just want to appreciate your question. I want to give a chance to other people to jump in. But I also, having been a student of organizational development myself, I mean, I think one of the things that's true, like a truism of this conversation is that a lot of these things have been bubbling through the fields of social dynamics, organizational design, teamwork, performance a long time. They're not necessarily new, but a lot of it is also readiness to hear the message.
Mm-hmm.
You know, I think that there is the idea of psychological safety or design, teams that are moving in design rather than static in design, this is probably not something brand new, but it's
right.
Something that's absolutely relevant to today's organizational dynamics. And so I know,
for example,
some of this is just very exciting for us as coaches because we're now being able to take some of the research that folks like Amy is doing, and people are actually willing to hear it. I think there were people speaking it 20 years ago, but nobody was listening.
Or maybe the world wasn't a readiness as complex. And spoken in a new way. Yeah.
Right. So listen, I have two really great questions, and I want to make sure we have 15 minutes left, and I just want to make sure we get to ask these questions. What I'll do, Amy, is I'm going to give you both these questions because they're kind of linked.
Okay.
And then step back and let you speak about them. One is, you know, managing a team on the fly that's geographically dispersed. I think a lot of us are grappling with this these days.
Yep.
Myself, I have a team that I'm working with where the members are in 5 different countries. And I imagine I'm not the only one that's running into this. That's
right.
The first question. And then the second one, maybe a little somewhat related, which is, have you noticed gender differences in terms of creating psychological safety? So folks, whether women or maybe I can expand it to just diversity in terms of the types of people that are effective at creating this concept of psychological safety.
I'm not sure if they're as linked as you'd think, but may I guess they
are. Maybe not.
Diversity. But I have written about it, in fact, in Chapter 6, which I think might be my favorite chapter of teaming. I talk, the chapter title is Teaming Across Boundaries, I think, and it's just all about this challenge. And I do talk about a study that I did with a doctoral student named Deborah Soule a number of years ago. And I would say the bottom line of that is – that the bottom line of that research is, wow, it really is hard. You know, it turns out, lo and behold, nothing new here. It really is hard to team across geographic, cultural, and disciplinary boundaries. Oh, by the way, time zone being part of that, cultural and geographic, at the same time. Like, it's darn hard. And in fact, we discovered a kind of a fifth, or maybe it's a fourth element, which is just the taken-for-granted knowledge, we call it situated knowledge, that's situated in a given facility. Right? It has nothing to do with the fact that we're in Japan or the Middle East or anywhere else. It's just this facility does things a certain way, and we kind of, begin to assume everyone does it this way and so on. So
There's
all these hidden barriers to collaboration. So, and what's the answer? My gosh, answer one is don't bother working this way, but I don't think we have that choice, so scratch that one. Answer two is we got to make it a lot more explicit and discussable. We've got to, even more than in normal, you know, face-to-face interactions, we've got to openly check, test assumptions, make sure we're not, recognize that we are in fact making assumptions all the time and raise them all the time. So it's a kind of deliberate slowing down of how we think and what we're saying and what we're planning to really clarify our mutual, to build mutual understanding. And, that's not easy to do, but it is doable. And it's going to pay off, right? Because primarily, unfortunately, it will pay off in the failures avoided. So, you won't necessarily get to see them. That's the problem. It's the dog that didn't bark. It doesn't, it doesn't make a big splash. But you can be sure that without this care, the misunderstandings and the failures do happen. So it's effortful, but I always think of that as like slightly good news for people like us. You know, it means we're needed to help them do that. Now, differences in gender and geography and so on, I mean, there's certainly, I haven't myself in my research seen or discovered gender differences in the experience of psychological safety. I think there's a slight increase in the chances that managers who are female are going to more naturally engage in some of the behaviors I've been describing that I've said contribute to psychological safety, more inquiry, more humility, more vulnerability. But I prefer to think of these as choices, as skills, as things that anyone can learn, and men as well as women, no question about it, and anyone can violate, men as well as women. There are others, not my research, but there's certainly people who study cross-cultural differences in terms of what's, face threat being a very rich feature of national culture, and how much face threat is acceptable is going to vary and be pretty hard to deal with. In fact, so hard in some cultures that they, literally have to, Malcolm Gladwell talks about the Korean airliner crashes, until finally they realized they had to have only pilots who could speak English because the Korean language itself builds in so much power distance into the language. If you're superior to me and I use a word that, accentuates their superiority, it literally made it too hard for them to speak up about the data they were seeing. So it's like, okay, right. I'm speaking English, because English has no such power distance built into its language. We have only politeness routines that we can that we can and do add in for high status people, but it's not quite as tricky. So those differences do exist, and I think there's a whole realm of expertise that is thus implied for helping people.
Yeah, I would have to reiterate that. My experience and my research has shown that the gender differences are muted compared to the cultural issues.
Yeah, interesting.
And that the cultural, especially communication, language, cultural views, authority, those seem to be much more deeply entrenched than some of the gender differences. So I can totally appreciate that and seen it. I'm sensitive to the fact that we're getting down to our last few minutes, and I have one question might be great for you to reflect on as a closing, because we started earlier talking a little bit about your work on learning zones, and Amy Stumm has sent in this great question asking to maybe share a little bit about what you've seen around a team that does a good job of creating a learning zone. Like, what does a best practice look like from your research around the learning component of this new way of teaming?
So do you mean building a learning zone?
Well, she's not specific. She's just saying that as the team moves in the evolution towards becoming a learning zone,
right.
I think what we're looking at is what are some of the best practices that you've seen that maybe as coaches we could be supporting our clients?
Yeah, I mean, I suppose in my mind, we should, whatever work you're doing, it should be taking place in a learning zone. So that's right. So I have this, you know, the learning zone I like to talk about is where our motivation / accountability for getting great things done together is extremely high, and psychological safety is high. Right? So it's both. I say that the learning zone occurs when we've got both that passion and motivation to do great work and that openness about what we know, what we don't know, asking for help, admitting mistakes, and so on. And when those two features come together, that's the learning zone, which I think that is requires leadership to bring it about, and requires a sort of everybody taking care of it like a precious thing to keep it alive, right? Because we can so quickly shift into the performance mindset where, you know, what do I really want to do here? Well, I want to show off. I want to look good. I want everybody to think well of me versus we want to learn. So I think that the learning zone is a leadership responsibility, coaching responsibility to help create the learning zone, to help move us from either a comfort zone where we feel safe but we don't feel motivated, or from the anxiety zone where we feel motivated but not safe, two different prescriptions slightly of, you know, whether we're moving one, you know, one way versus the other way, to get us into that learning zone and then to together make it a shared responsibility to take care of it and to keep renewing it and nurturing it.
Yeah, I love what you're saying, because I think it also connects to the question about geographic dispersion and the challenges of creating either a sense of safety or inclusion or a learning zone with those kinds of obstacles. Because what you're pointing to is being explicit about the challenge, right? That as the leader, you want to actually put that elephant on the table. I know when I'm coaching teams that are dispersed around the world and they want to create a sense of cohesion or they want to create a sense of belonging, it's interesting because it's so obvious that they don't do it. Now, I'll suggest to the leader, why don't you actually talk about that exact thing? Like, instead of talking about your goals and instead of talking about your week's work and going around and hearing from everybody about their to-do list, why don't you actually discuss the challenge of feeling like a sense of team or what we're learning together or what we – so, yeah, you're pointing to this need to be explicit as a leader.
What can each one of us do to contribute to the creation of a psychologically safe zone or a motivated, you know, passionate team about whatever it is? What can each one, you know, I can hold you accountable, you can hold me accountable for getting this done.
Right. Yeah, it requires the leader to do, I think, two things that you point to extensively in your work is, number one is to speak explicitly about that vision, about the goal, about the sense of creating a teaming as a verb, as you say. And then number two, a different level of listening. Right? Because if you're asking for input from people, whether they're in China or they're across the table from you, you have to be willing to listen to them maybe at a deeper level than you have historically. So I think those are two of the key things that I know I keep in mind in coaching, in trying to create a team that's like a learning zone. Any other parting thoughts? This is so rich. I feel like I could keep you on all afternoon, but
you're very kind.
I'm not going to do that to you. But anyway,
I always feel very inadequate aloud compared to in writing. So for people who are interested and, you know, want to go deeper, I'll refer you to the book or some of the articles that I mentioned, because it's there's where I try to be very careful in writing.
Yeah, and I have to say that some of the case studies that you wrote about are really wonderful examples, whether it's in the hospital setting or some of the others, the idea of you know, what you've seen in terms of leaders that do create psychological safety was extremely helpful for me. Because, you know, getting your arms around what is safety is not as simple, whether it's as a coach or as a leader. You know, again, getting back to the questioner from the OD perspective, I mean, I think we've been trying to get our arms around safety for centuries, right?
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And it's still a very complex animal. It's like you know it when you see it, and you can feel it when you're in it. But being able to create it is a very challenging thing.
Well, because it starts by modeling it and modeling, you know, being vulnerable and so on.
And that's it also starts at having us step back and rethink what it means to be an authority figure. I think that, you know, creating safety for people to be in a group leadership context is, I mean, the theory may have been around for a long time, but it's still relatively new for a lot of leaders to share the power. So anyway, I'm going to let you go. I would really want to thank you from the Institute of Coaching and encourage people to get online. If you're interested in some of the articles that Amy mentioned, some of them are in the masterclass. And there are points related to coaching and how it relates to her work. Feel free to write to me. I've had a couple of folks write to me and ask me for Amy's publications. I did a lot of research on her work in putting together the masterclass, and there are some wonderful articles in addition to the ones she mentioned. So there is a rich compendium of material that we can all go dig into and follow up with this. And I just want to take this minute and thank Amy for taking a big chunk of her day to be with us. We really, really appreciate it. And hopefully we'll see you soon, maybe at the next conference.
Terrific. Thank you.
So thank you all. And for those of you that have a desire to get CEUs, I think you want to follow up with the Institute. There's an evaluation you'll need to fill out to get your CEU certification. And so let us know if you have any questions about that. And as Sue mentioned at the beginning of the call, there will be a recording of this call. So if you'd like to listen and use it as a resource, I think within a few days it should be available on our website. And it is 1:30, and I like to be on time. So thank you all for joining us, and stay in touch. Take care, everyone.